Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking to Dr. Britta Eger about her book titled The Scent of Ancient Magic, just published in 2023 by the University of Michigan Press. This book, as the title suggests, explores the complex interconnection of scent and magic in the Greek world and the Roman world, drawing on all sorts of very cool sources, ancient literature, modern study of the senses, ancient medicinal and botanical understandings, to investigate how ancient magicians used scents as part of their smells, as kind of ways of understanding the world. This book does not itself smell like anything, but has so many very fascinating stories of scent and descriptions of scent in it. Britta, I'm really excited to welcome you to the podcast to tell us all about it.
I'm really excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Before we dive into all of the scents, though, and all of the magic, could you introduce yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. So I did a PhD in classics, and I used to teach in the field. And I've done research in ancient magic, ancient religion, ancient agriculture, which is more connected to those other two things than you might think. And I started noticing that in looking at ancient magical material, there is this very common equation of sense and magic. They kept cropping up in the same texts. And eventually, I started to realize that scent was kind of being used as a metaphor for magic in various ways. And I think this makes a lot of sense on a sort of instinctive level where, you know, scent is this sort of mysterious and yet everyday phenomenon where we can't see scent, we can't touch it, get a hold of it, and yet we know it affects us profoundly. Scents can make us nauseated or hungry, or, you know, we get that flashbulb memory when we smell something that reminds us of a memory from years ago. So it's this really profound and yet, you know, very common everyday phenomenon. And I think, you know, that sort of intangibility but powerful aspect to scent made it a really handy, useful mental model for the way people imagine magic to work. So as I noticed this in a variety of ancient texts, I also kind of realized nobody had talked about this. And I thought it was very interesting. And I wanted to, I thought I was going to write an article on it. I thought I'd, you know, do this nice little self-contained project on it. And then it eventually turned into something much longer.
That is not the first time I've heard, "I thought this was just going to be an article."
I'm sure.
And yet here we are. So I want to pick up on this idea as scent as a mental model. I thought that was really cool for thinking about magic, going beyond just the idea of, well, of course, scent is relevant. It's one of the senses. Can you tell us about this idea of it being a mental model for magic, and especially when we think about the world of the Greeks and Romans?
Sure. And yeah, I think it's worth taking that step back before we come to them in particular to say this really is a worldwide phenomenon. When you start looking at the connections between scent and magic, we see this worldwide in all sorts of different cultures across many time periods, that it just seems to be this gut level reaction that ghosts, gods, the supernatural, spells share something with that lived experience of scent being being something powerful but intangible. In the world of the Greeks and Romans in particular, like we find this on both a conscious and an unconscious level. I was talking in the book about both what real magicians did, which we can certainly get into in more detail, real magicians who we know through texts like preserved spell books from Greco-Roman Egypt. They used scent very liberally in their rituals for a bunch of reasons that I'd love to talk about. But we also see authors of imaginative literature using scent in very deliberate ways as a metaphor for magic. And that gets very interestingly gendered as well. And, you know, this equation between scent and power, scent and the supernatural and scent, it's something that we find in both Greek and Roman culture and in other ancient Mediterranean cultures. Like there's this strong equation between scent and the gods in ancient Egypt. And it just seems to be a very human thing cross-culturally.
Intriguing. Lots to get into now that we have kind of that background. This to me seemed kind of almost like a silly question, and then I was really pleased to find it in the book because I was really curious about it. Obviously, scent, like we don't have archives of scent, right, the way that we do for other sorts of things. So what was a good scent? What was a bad smell in these time periods, and how could we possibly know?
Scent really is kind of the forgotten sense in a lot of ways. And we actually have the Greeks to blame for that kind of in our mental model of how the world works. Ancient scientists and philosophers like Aristotle, for example, prioritized scent as kind of like the lowest, most bestial of the senses, as opposed to sight and sound, which were sort of the higher, more refined senses. But at the same time, the literature of the past is full of discussion about scent. Often in a sort of less structured, less deliberate way than we hear a discussion about, say, music or painting or other types of art. But at the same time, we do get a lot of ancient impressions of scent. So as for what's a good scent and a bad scent and how we know, we have a lot of ancient reactions to different scents recorded. So people talk about perfumes that they think are beautiful smelling. And you know, a lot of these would be very familiar to us. So for example, lily perfume, rose perfume, things that we would definitely say, oh yes, that's, you know, something I would consider wearing as a nice scent. People in the past had the same reaction. And it's interesting here because scent is, there's some broad similarities in how humans react to different scents. Humans generally like sort of sweet flowery smells like those lily and rose perfumes, and humans generally dislike sort of rotting smells where those seem to be baked in biological responses to things in our environment, sort of saying, you know, don't put that in your mouth or whatever. But at the same time, beyond those really broad responses, our responses to scent are very, very individual. And so, you know, we find a wide variety of scents in antiquity, which correspond to sort of those big categories. You know, people like spicy smells, people like flowery smells. We get, for example, a lot of discussions of the way temples smell in antiquity, where visitors to temples, you know, mention them as being full of the scent of incense smoke in Greek and Egyptian and Roman culture and others. And that's really the sort of sensory memory or one of the sensory memories that they take away from their visit to that temple. So sometimes people say very explicitly, you know, this is a good scent or this is a bad scent. There's a poem I'm thinking of here by the Latin poet Martial. It's this really sort of nasty, misogynistic poem where he's talking about how terrible a woman smells as a way to insult her. And the things that he compares her to are things like, oh, she smells like a goat. She smells like a jar of stale urine that somebody broke in the street, and so on. So, you know, sometimes people are telling us very explicitly, like, I like this scent or I don't like this scent. But then other times we just sort of look at what people mention eating or burning for incense, the magical papyri, those spell books from Egypt that I mentioned, they're full of recipes for things like incenses that magicians are supposed to use as part of their rituals, both good smelling incenses and bad smelling incenses. And in those cases, we can kind of tell which is supposed to smell good and which is supposed to smell bad according to probably just what do they contain. Like an incense that contains dog droppings is probably not supposed to smell good, but also what they're being used for. You use a nice smelling incense if you're trying to do a spell with a good outcome, and you're supposed to use a bad smelling incense if you're doing something sort of more hostile and illicit.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense, and is a fascinating kind of insight into both what people thought then, but also kind of how one excavates that now.
And actually, it's interesting as somebody trying to reconstruct the scent world of the past, because there's a real temptation to sort of reconstruct literally what existed in an ancient environment and then kind of react to it the way that we would react to it and not necessarily the way that the ancients would react to it, which can be two different things. Like I mentioned the smell of temples and, incense wreathed or filled with incense is a very common epithet in Greek poetry for temples. This is how they remember their religious spaces, as sweet smelling. At the same time, there's been all of this research in modern scholarship on what ancient temples actually smelled like and the religious experience. And I mean, to our senses, they must have been pretty terrible smelling. We're dealing with a culture in which animal sacrifice is one of the basic acts of worship. You think about, what a Greek temple would have smelled like in July with, cows being sacrificed and offal and excrement and blood. And like our reaction of that is, oh God, it must have smelled absolutely foul. But that's not how the Greeks remember their temples. I mean, we can think about our own experience here. I think this is an example that I used in the book, where if you think about the way that we conceptualize holidays, if you think about Christmas, for example, here's a holiday where even if you don't celebrate it, there's this sort of broad cultural understanding of like what senses go along with this holiday, because it's, pervasive in advertising and TV and so on. So you might list Christmas as smelling like, warm cookies and pine and cinnamon and all of these good things. And I mean, your lived experience of Christmas may also involve a lot of like sweaty winter boots and a wet dog and car exhaust as you go shopping and so on. But that's not the important part as we remember the holiday. So I think it's important for us not to be too literal when we look at the past and reconstruct literally, okay, what sense do we know are present, but also to think about like what is the cultural experience that people are kind of curating and remembering of a particular space or occasion or person.
So that links really nicely to something else I wanted to ask you about that you've teased a little bit already, the idea that studying ancient magic and ancient agriculture might actually have more in common than we'd think today. Because you talk about in the book the, quote, conscious and unconscious equations, which is a fascinating phrase in this context, to understand what ancient Greeks were doing with medicine and botany, making links between power, including like divine power, medicine, and scent. And looking at that today, as you've just said, we might not see there being any sort of equation between medicine and weeds in the ground and magic. And yet there is very much in this world. So can you tell us about some of those conscious and unconscious equations?
Sure. So starting with magic and agriculture, because I think that's a great sort of everyday example. I actually wrote my dissertation entirely on magic used by Roman farmers, where there's really a lot. But at the same time, the authors who record this for us are upper class educated men, because this is whose words we generally have preserved from antiquity. And it's clear that for a lot of them, they feel like these traditional remedies they've been taught, which can include little spoken spells or sort of herbal remedies or charms, things like amulets that you can tie onto, say, a sick ox, or little procedures you can do to make your crops grow better or keep your animals healthy. Like, these authors clearly feel that these things work on some level. But at the same time, they want to present themselves as these like educated men of science who are kind of above all of that superstitious nonsense that the peasants practice. So a lot of what they're doing is they're taking these like this very traditional folklore, and they're kind of saying, okay, like the common people believe that this is quote unquote magic, but we men of science actually understand that this is a type of science that obeys natural laws if you just are, you know, sufficiently educated in the topic. So they're really looking for ways to brush up, you know, the charm that they've learned where you tie, say, a turnip onto a sick person, and that will help them get better. And I sort of brush that up and explain it through, you know, they're breathing in particles from this plant, and it actually has this medicinal effect. So, and that's very common for, I shouldn't just say ancient science. It's very common for science in general to kind of look for an explanation for why something that we already believe works, and to kind of hold on to the remedy and just come up with a different, more satisfying explanation for it. And there's a lot of these sort of folk charms, folk remedies in the ancient agricultural handbooks. This makes sense. People were living often at a subsistence level where if your crops failed, you were going to be going hungry that year. People really look for ways to ensure success as much as possible because their survival depends on it. So anything you can do on your farm to keep you, yourself, your family, your people healthy, to keep your animals alive and productive, to keep your farm growing and running well, you know, if you think it'll work, you'll do it. And we see this as well in the world of medical literature, where, you know, very often we do get, you know, authors that we might now categorize as early medical authors looking to the folklore of their day and saying, well, you know, I think this traditional remedy actually works. If you tie this particular plant onto a person, or if they, you, if you, you know, make it into a smoke and they breathe it in, then this will cure whatever ails them. But we also know that while they are presenting themselves as part of the medical profession, there's also this whole class of people called root cutters and other similar terms who are practicing medicine in a kind of more like, yeah, folkloric manner, where there's this sort of common ancient knowledge that certain plants are good magically, they're good medically, they're just powerful, and you can use them in different ways. Some people say, you know, we'll make this into a potion you can drink. Other people say, you know, we'll put this under your pillow while you sleep and it will cure you. And we know that people we would sort of classify as like doctors and scientists are in dialogue with these other people. And these two groups are starting in the 5th century or so in Greece, really defining themselves in opposition to each other as sort of competing claimants to special knowledge. And the whole idea of medicine as a profession is kind of created to distinguish these sort of more upper class medical practitioners from these usually depicted as more lower class, you know, village and itinerant professionals who offer a variety of services from, you know, making medicine out of plants to exorcism.
So I was really intrigued by these root cutters because we have kind of passed down to us an idea of what a magician is and obviously a doctor, but we don't have root cutters now. And kind of in that description, you've given us a bunch of reasons kind of why not. But given that their work was in a lot of ways sort of on the ground, in the dirt with the plants, why were they seen as dangerous?
So the profession that we know as raiz de tomoi or root cutters, there's a couple of other terms here, like herb sellers, and it seems like there was a pretty lively world of people with these little niche specialties that has been kind of lost, and they've all been lumped together in our surviving literature to a large extent. So we hear about people who seem to be like specialty plant hunters. This is one of the reasons the doctors talk about them, because they're often sourcing materials from these people. But then we also get people who are closer to circus performers and pharmacists. And like we hear about, for example, a fellow who has a stall in the Athenian Agora and who sort of puts on shows where he drinks poison and sort of sits around and the audience sort of waits to see if he'll die or not. And he's apparently built up a tolerance to this. So we seem to have a wide variety of people, ranging from showmen to herbalists to religious professionals, where a lot of these people kind of shade into people who can offer you ritual practices like exorcism or other things like cursing your enemies. And it looks like they all kind of shade into each other. There's a couple of different reasons why they're dangerous. For one thing, they work with plants which are considered powerful. And a lot of these plants are thought to need special care and handling, particularly when you go to collect them. So we have a wide variety of rituals preserved from antiquity in which people say things like, okay, before you dig up hellebore or peony or other plants which are considered very efficacious, you need to do things like draw a circle around them in the dirt with a sword and say a prayer and burn some incense. And if you don't do these things correctly, a wide variety of bad things might happen to you. The plant itself is so dangerous that it may kill you when you pull it out of the ground. The gods may be angry with you. The plant itself is sometimes seen as sort of sentient and may get its revenge on you if you're not careful. So these are people who work with dangerous plants, have dangerous expertise. And I mean, the line between curing somebody with medicine and poisoning them is very fine. And we do have a number of accounts from antiquity of people who try to make either medicine or things like love potions and wind up poisoning somebody by accident. And that's something we can certainly talk more about, where do we get ancient accusations of magic being used. So that's one answer. These are people with dangerous expertise who are working with dangerous materials. And sort of the more meta view of this is that I mentioned that sort of doctors, medical professionals came to be seen as higher class, like the educated variety of them. And a lot of these people who we're talking about are lower class, usually illiterate or partially illiterate, usually seen as lower on the social scale. And it's inherently threatening to a lot of people, the idea of this type of potent power in the hands of people who, in other aspects of ancient society, are much less powerful, who are not supposed to have power if you're an ancient elite. So, and that's true of a lot of ancient magic, that magic is often a fundamentally countercultural phenomenon where it offers a promise of being able to affect the world, of being able to do things that you wouldn't otherwise, often in situations in which you are otherwise powerless, whether you're a farmer who can't affect the weather but desperately needs to and may turn to a spell, or if you're somebody on the lowest rungs of ancient society and you know you're not going to get justice for a crime committed against you in the normal way of things, or you're a desperate sick person who knows that the doctors don't have anything to offer you. These are all situations in which people turn to more supernatural remedies, hoping for an answer that they don't find elsewhere in their society.
All right. I can see why that would all seem pretty dangerous. And of course, it's intriguing to think about kind of which plants were the ones that, if you pull them out of the ground, even just pulling them out of the ground, was in itself dangerous. How do you even think of that?
Yeah, and some of them are not what we would expect. For example, the peony is considered very dangerous by the Greeks. They actually say, don't pull a peony out of the ground yourself, get a dog and tie a rope to the peony and to the dog and sort of lure the dog into pulling it out of the ground for you. And then the dog will supposedly drop dead at the moment that the roots pull out. So yeah, this is worrying.
That's intense.
It's intense. And then at other times, it's plants that we might see as very common and normal. Like one thing we may want to talk about in more detail is garlic, which we, you know, generally think of as a tasty kitchen ingredient. But, you know, thinking about the folklore of garlic, the Greeks considered a very powerful and potentially dangerous plant.
Okay, you definitely have to tell us more about that. What did the ancient Greeks and Romans think about garlic?
Okay, so, you know, if we think about the supernatural and garlic, what is the one thing that you know garlic is good against, even in modern culture?
Vampires?
Vampires. So this is actually like the most common, well-known today piece of a much larger body of folklore in Europe, where allium plants, all of those nice sort of sulfurous smelling plants like garlic and leek and chives, are considered, for whatever reason, to be good against the supernatural, witches, vampires, monsters of all sorts. This is a very active body of folklore in ancient Greece and Rome, where on the one hand, you know, garlic is something people eat. It's here we get into class again. It's considered a particularly lower class food. We get the Latin poet Horace complaining about the fact that he was served garlic at dinner. He describes it as sort of a nasty trick by the host, who should know that his delicate intestines can't handle peasant food like that. But at the same time, you know, very commonly eaten, even if Horace complains about it. But at the same time, you know, it's this incredibly powerful smelling plant, which people thought was good against the supernatural in various ways. So people say, you know, garlic is a great charm against witches. There's a poem, for example, that says if you want to protect babies, garlic is a good way to keep witches away from them. And yeah, it's considered a great prophylactic against a variety of potential monsters and boogeymen. And at the same time, I think that... So we also see garlic being used essentially, or at least later authors thought it was being used as a charm against witches in some of our earliest surviving Greek literature, the Odyssey, where there's this episode in the Odyssey where Odysseus and his crew stop at the island, which they don't know this yet, but it's inhabited by the witch Circe. And so Odysseus sends off half of his crew to investigate the smoke they see rising from the middle of this island, and his crew finds the house of Circe, and she welcomes them in and offers them food and drink like a good Greek hostess, and then she turns them into pigs, as she does. So Odysseus eventually goes to search for his missing men, and the god Hermes stops him along the way and says, sort of spoiler, you're heading for Circe's house. She's going to try to turn you into a pig like she's already done to your crew. Take this plant. And Hermes gives Odysseus a plant that the poem calls molu, which Homer specifically says is what the gods call it. This special plant, this is not something, like it's a mythical plant. We don't have an actual plant in ancient Greek that everybody agreed was called molu or molly, as we would say in English. So Odysseus takes this plant and he carries it with him, and it prevents, when he gets to Circe's house, it prevents her from changing him into a pig the way she has done to his men. So here, you know, this magical plant that Hermes has given him is a great charm against this witch. Now, the reason I bring this up in relation to garlic is because later authors got really interested in the question of, okay, if the gods call this magical plant molu, what do we call it? What is the real plant that we could find that Homer was talking about? And they came up with a couple of different answers. Molu is described in the Odyssey as having a white flower and a dark root with a sort of big bulb on it. And the ancients looked around for bulb plants that could fit this description, and garlic was one of the favorite answers that they came up with, that this, you know, magical plant that can keep a witch off must be garlic. And I mean, that's a really interesting equation of looking at a piece of ancient literature and saying, okay, what in our experience could this map onto? What is the real story behind this myth? And such was Garlick's reputation. It seemed like a really good candidate, both from the physical description and from the effect of the plant, for lying behind this mythical flower in Homer.
Okay, definitely going to go look at the garlic in a jar in the fridge a little bit differently after this conversation. I think a lot of other people will too. Moving away then from root cutters, moving away from plants as the kind of subjective magical sense for a second, the book does have magicians. Now, I admit, these are not exactly the magicians I'd initially imagined in my head. There's a particular thing going on, the magical papyrus tradition. Who were these magicians, and what were they doing with scent?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, who were these magicians is an active question in classics, because they don't tell us a lot about themselves. We have these ancient scrolls, which survive, which are recipe books for, okay, how do you do different rituals? And they are very much recipe books where they tell you, okay, here's your instructions for setting up your ritual. Here's the words you need to say. Here's the incense you need to burn. There's a lot of little recipes for things like incense that you need to make ahead of time. Here's what you should expect from these, what you should expect the effect of these spells to be. Even calling them books of magic is a little bit contentious because, like, some of the stuff in them are clearly like what we would call spells. So there's one, for example, to make your boss stop being angry with you, or there's one to curse your enemies. But a lot of them, the people using them probably would have described more as like private religious rituals, where very often what they're trying to do is to become an initiate of a particular god. And so they're trying to carry out a little private religious ceremony at their house in which they often invite the god to come and speak with them. And we're talking about a variety of deities here, Apollo and Selene, and depending on what period, we get texts mentioning angels. Who is actually doing these is a fascinating question, because these texts are really comprised of a lot of different cultural traditions. They're found from, like, we know that they were used widely in the ancient world, but they're preserved for us primarily from the Roman period of ancient Egypt. And looking at those books that we have, it seems clear that the people using them are going to be largely bilingual. They're going to know probably ancient Egyptian and Greek and potentially other languages as well. Some of these texts show influences from Jewish traditions, later on Christian traditions, other Near Eastern religions, as well as Latin and Greek culture. So you're getting really this mix. What we can say about the magicians, just sort of inferring from the texts, is that they seem to be largely educated and relatively well-off men, largely, potentially women as well. Some of the texts do mention female magicians, but we can tell this because a lot of the rituals involved would have required expensive ingredients, a fair amount of time and privacy, which, you know, busier working people in more crowded houses would not have, and a high degree of literacy in often multiple languages. So we assume that these magicians are sort of more upper class, sort of practicing, either professional or amateur magicians who are interested enough in these procedures to really spend a lot of money and time on them.
Too bad they didn't leave any, like, you know, here's our list of members and why we do this.
I know. And actually, we know that a lot of these books existed, but there were various purges of magicians and books. So we do hear about events where, you know, in a particular city, people, the authorities gather up magical books and make a point of burning them to try to get rid of some of this. It's believed that a lot of these surviving spell books may actually be from one particular magician's library. So our view of ancient magic may be in some ways very skewed by like one person's personal collection. But at the same time, like some of the shorter texts are often things like tiny, tiny little scrolls that were rolled up and worn inside metal lockets as amulets. So you know, a lot of people had access to this type of magic, even if they couldn't necessarily practice it themselves. You could go to somebody who would write you out an amulet against a fever or write a curse for you. We have a lot of those. Or, you know, do other sort of magical procedures for you, even if you yourself were not a magician.
So speaking of burning things, people doing magic for you, and of course curses, we have to talk about witches. Which, you know, we've talked about vampires, we have to talk about witches. And a bunch of the things that we've talked about so far have been in a lot of ways common or relatively common across the Greek into the Roman period. So I was really interested that in your book, you talk about how Greeks and Romans both have a conception of witch, and both have conceptions of witches having sense. That's like seems to be a key part of what a witch looks like. But their idea of what a witch smells like, the scents around a witch, are actually, in a lot of ways, pretty different. Can you take us through kind of what did the Greeks and the Romans think a witch smelled like?
Yeah, sure. So like, we're moving here from talking about what real magicians seem to have verifiably done into the world of imaginary literature. And, you know, epic poems and novels. And I kind of want to emphasize at the beginning here that we get this really interesting gender flip as we move from reality into fantasy, where our better evidence for real practicing ancient magicians in things like the spell books and historical sources talk mainly about male magicians. We know that female ones existed too. We get the occasional references to them, but it seems to be, when we're talking about, you know, highly educated magicians, mostly guys. When we move into the world of imaginary literature, it's all witches. It's largely women who are the, you know, scary magical practitioners that people want stories about. And you know, again, sort of thinking about social power, I think that's pretty interesting. But yeah, Greeks and Romans had originally very different conceptions of witches. So when we look at Greek literature, you know, we get witches like Circe in the Odyssey, Medea in a variety of ancient poems. And they're largely demigoddesses. These are humans who have divine parentage in, you know, their parents or their grandparents. And they are largely, you know, royalty, very, very upper class, and they're depicted as generally young, beautiful women, and they smell sweet. So they smell like perfume, incense. I'm thinking here, for example, of the great epic poem, The Argonautica, which is where we get the story of Jason and the Golden Fleece by Apollonius in the Greek world. The story is much older than him, but he's sort of the first surviving long account of it. And his Medea, she smells nice. She's a young maiden living in her father, the king's palace, and she serves as a priestess, and she smells like the incenses from the temple and like her, you know, lovely lotions and the herbs that she gathers. And she is, her scent is a little bit ambiguous though, because she smells also like scary herbs. She's got some dangerous herbs that she gives to Jason he has to face a variety of trials at various points. And so she gives him some of those dangerous herbs that we've talked about with the root cutters, because she is very much being depicted as a female root cutter. And that's what a lot of the early Greek witches are. They're sort of the female equivalents of those male professionals who are dangerous and scary, but They're also sort of beautiful and sexy and alluring, and they smell good. When we get to the Roman world, on the other hand, Roman witches, starting with the earliest surviving Latin literature, they're really the flip side of that. They're old, they're ugly, and in early Latin literature, they're not particularly scary. They're just kind of ridiculous. They're generally depicted as sort of like drunken old women who are not particularly powerful. Until we get to the Roman poet Horace, who really creates for us a fusion of Greek and Roman traditions and gives us this image of the sort of like really powerful, scary Halloween witch that we're still in many ways drawing on today. So Horace creates this witch, Canidia, as a character. And like Roman witches, she's old, she's ugly, her hair is white, her teeth are black, she wears dirty, ragged clothing, she has long fingernails that she digs up graves with, is sort of any horrifying detail that you can imagine. And she smells rotten and like grave dirt and the blood of animals and so on. She has snakes in her hair. But she's also as powerful as those Roman witches. And that fusion of, you know, the ridiculous old lower class Roman witch. The Roman witches are often depicted as like former prostitutes who kind of aged out of the profession and have now turned to magic to do love charms. You know, the fusion of that with the really powerful, scary, semi-divine Greek witches, it really kicks off a period of witch literature for the Romans, in which witches were just kind of a fad during Augustan literature. Suddenly everybody was writing witch poems. And I think, you know, thinking about how literature connects to real life, I think part of the reason for the sudden fascination with witches at that particular moment in Roman history is because we're in a period of civil war. We're talking here about the series of civil wars in which Julius Caesar first takes over Rome as a dictator, gets assassinated, and then his heirs fight it out for another couple of decades. And there were a number of very powerful and to Roman men, very threatening women who were prominent in the politics of this time period. The best known of them probably being Cleopatra, who, in addition to being powerful and sensuous and a woman, is also foreign. So adding another sort of level of otherness to her. And I see a lot of this witch literature and the sort of fascination with, you know, old, ugly witches who can do love charms to make men fall in love with them, even though they smell disgusting and rotten and are repulsive, sort of overcoming men's better sense. Is in many ways, you know, the Roman elite kind of working out their terror of, oh God, women in politics.
So in this idea, especially in this context of kind of suspicions of trickery, of fakery, how do, I guess, in some senses, the more mundane, that at least now, perfume, makeup, you know, a little bit of color here, nice smelling thing there. Cleopatra, for example, we think of traditionally as having a lot of makeup on. How does that fit into this context of witchery and suspicion?
Yeah, and I find this fascinating partly because I feel like we've come back around very much to this sort of dialogue in the modern world, where there's this just a long-standing trope in ancient literature that perfume, that cosmetics are quasi-magical insofar as they make men do things that they wouldn't otherwise. So, for example, an author, Pliny, talks about how a woman walks down the street wearing perfume, and you know, men stop what they're doing and their heads turn and follow her because of this bewitching scent that she's wearing. And that's very much the attitude to perfume in a lot of the more gendered ancient literature, focusing on women wearing perfume in particular, the idea that perfume is itself something akin to magic insofar as it alters your mind. It makes you do something that you wouldn't otherwise, maybe fall for a woman that you wouldn't otherwise. And same with cosmetics. And, you know, here, Again, we're sort of back around to this idea in the modern world where you get all of these sort of misogynistic complaints about how women are tricking men by wearing cosmetics. This is in some way, like cheating, that wearing makeup will trick a guy into falling in love with you when he wouldn't otherwise. And here, like, a scent is relevant for cosmetics as well, because a lot of ancient cosmetics were made with things like rose petals and honey and would themselves have had a scent. And so I think they and perfumes kind of get lumped in together as things that just, you breathe them in and your good sense deserts you.
Huh. Interesting. And interesting, especially to see the kind of modern parallels. So thank you for taking us through those connections. I'd like to, as we come towards the end, sort of go from kind of the bad side of scent, the evil, the scary, to, I don't know, the divine, shall we see? You talk about in the book, we've talked a little bit about temples, but there's more in the book about divinity, about gods. And one of the things that I found really interesting is something you wrote in the book, that scent can, quote, perpetuate sanctity through time as well as space. And in some ways, we've talked about that a little bit in terms of scent memory and temples. But could you tell us kind of how all these things come together?
Sure. So we see a very deliberate curation of religious spaces and occasions through scent, both in the private sphere and in public. So in public, we've talked about temples as sort of destinations that Greeks and Romans would go to, where they're full of the scent of incense and roasting meat from sacrificial animals. And like the ancients really wanted their sanctuaries to smell nice. They'd be full of greenery and often plants growing on the temple grounds. But we also, like, we even hear about a temple in which the plaster that the temple is covered with is filled with saffron to try to infuse the temple, presumably with a scent just emanating from the building itself. On the more private side, or a little bit more to say about public here, This sort of goes beyond the temple grounds itself, where on religious occasions, festivals, parades, you get people deliberately sort of carving out a ritual space with scent. So as part of a procession, people will, for example, carry incense burners, and that smoke and the scent of the incense will be drawing out the root of the procession. And very often these processions would have made a circuit around an area, like the city walls or an individual person's farm, that they're trying to protect with the effect of whatever ceremony they're doing, whether it's for the crops or for the health of the city or to honor a particular god. You're sort of drawing that boundary both visually and with your nose by really creating this bubble of incensed space as part of the festival. And we see the magicians of the papyri do this as well, where they use scent a lot. It's hard to overemphasize just how much they are trying to scent the spaces in which they are doing their rituals. So they're burning incense. They often need a fire going as part of their ritual procedure, and they'll burn scented wood like cedar on that. They're using perfume both to cover themselves and just sort of pouring it out to scent their environment. They're chewing on spices to perfume their breath. They're even writing with ink scented with myrrh or other ingredients. So they're really sort of creating this little bubble for themselves of scented space. And I think, part of that is, like, you're driving out the sense of everyday life. You're creating this little space and time that feels removed from your everyday life, and in which there's a lot of work actually on how scent can alter our perception of reality and how it alters our mindset. And I think the magicians of the papyri are doing this very deliberately to sort of you know, step out of themselves into this space where a meeting with a god or a magical effect feels more possible to them. The ancients are very, very deliberately creating these spaces and times, both at the level of whole communities and sometimes, you know, just for themselves in private rituals to really create ritual moments.
Hmm. Fascinating, especially kind of seeing the scent being used on all the different levels of the space, of the ink, of the breath. Kind of it really gives this sense of just how pervasive scent was when we think about ancient magic. I really only have one final question. You've taken us brilliantly through ancient magic and how it thought about and used scent in these different contexts, these different kinds of magic practitioners. Is there anything you might be working on now or next, whether or not it has to do with scent, magic, or books?
Unfortunately, I've gotten out of academia recently, but I don't know. I had a book that I was hoping to write on ancient agriculture and sort of how people perform agriculture in a public fashion as part of, for example, a politician creating a reputation for himself. And on the more magical side of things, I have this article that I really want to write on ancient curses on trees, which is a larger genre than you might think. Talking about agricultural magic, there's actually this large number of curses that people make against trees, not because they dislike the tree, but because they want it to be more productive. So I'll end with one of my favorite spells from all of antiquity, which it comes to us from the 10th century agricultural manual from Byzantium called the Geoponica. And it says that if you have a nut tree that is not producing nuts, then what you do is you take an axe in your hand and you go running up to the tree as if you're going to cut it down. But you have previously arranged with a friend to sort of run into the scene from the wings and catch your arm and say, "No, no, the tree understands what it's done wrong. I will make myself responsible for the behavior. I'm sure the tree will behave much better from now on, and the tree will be ashamed and start producing for you."
Okay. All right. Well, those are some very entertaining and fascinating thoughts to leave us with. So thank you very much. The book that we've been discussing again is titled The Scent of Ancient Magic from the University of Michigan Press. Bridget, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great conversation.